Did you know the ESO Network has a brand new Patreon? That's right, we're asking for your help, and you could do it for as little as a dollar a month. Don't fret, all your favorite shows will still be available for free as always, but you can get exclusive podcasts and more not heard anywhere else but on our Patreon. To sign up for the ESO Network Patreon's easy. All you have to do is go to esopodcast.com and click on the link. With your support of the ESO Network, it's you who will reap the rewards.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 141 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Adventures of the Super Sons number 8, Batman number 66, Doomsday Clock number 9, Green Arrow number 50, Justice League number 19, The Green Lantern number 5, Young Justice number 3, Supergirl season 4 episode 14, Stand and Deliver, Arrow season 7 episode 15, Training Day, Black Lightning season 2 episode 15, The Book of Apocalypse Chapter 1, The Alpha, Flash, Season 5, Episode 16, Failure is an Orphan, and Doom Patrol, Season 1, Episode 5, Paw Patrol. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, first up for DC news, Frank Miller and John Romita Jr. are working on a Superman Year 1 trilogy. The first issue arrives in June in a large format periodical version, followed by issue number 2 in August and issue number 3 in October. The complete 3-issue story arc will be collected up in a single volume that will hit bookstores in November.
That's a fast turnaround. That's interesting.
That is a fast turnaround. And if you noticed, it's, what is it, like 3 months between issues coming out? 2 months between issues coming out. So it's 2 months between, so they're taking the time to get it done, which I appreciate. And they're going to have it out like the month after it's completed, which is kind of amazing.
I'm wondering if we're kind of seeing the emergence of a new kind of format for how DC's going to be putting some stuff out.
It makes sense, doesn't it?
I think it makes a ton of sense. I think this is something that will probably sell really well, to be honest with you. I mean, it's Frank Miller and John Romita Jr., but I'd be lying if I said I was interested in it. I'm not a huge fan of stuff that Frank Miller has done recently. Not crazy about John Romita Jr. And this is just personal taste. I know they have really big fan bases, both of them. But I have to say, like, if there was a character that I would be least interested in seeing Frank Miller write, it's Superman. I think he writes a terrible Superman. So, yeah, I'm sure it's going to do really well. That's good for DC, but it's going to be a pass on my part.
Even if we review it for the show?
Oh, you know, I'll read it, but I'm just letting you know. I'm not.
You're not going to be happy?
Getting something good.
So we're going to be listening to Cletus complain when we're reviewing it.
Possibly. I feel like I have admitted when something is actually good that I wasn't expecting. I do feel like I admit to that.
You do. So I'm sure we'll have fans wanting us to review it. So
yeah,
it'll be on our list. So no worries there. All right, up next for DC news, and I'm going to butcher this name. Izay Morales is joining the Titans show on the DC Universe app as Deathstroke. I'm not familiar with this actor.
I'm not either. I am pretty excited to see Deathstroke on this show, though. I mean, especially with the style and aesthetic that they're going with on the show in terms of the violence and all of that, I think he is a very good fit.
Yes, definitely. All right, up next for DC News, Arrow showrunner, executive producer Beth Schwartz has signed a multi-year overall deal with Warner Brothers Television. Schwartz has worked on Arrow since its first season, moving up from writer's assistant to writer, executive story editor, co-executive producer and then showrunner in 2018. And she has additionally wrote and consulted on DC's Legends Tomorrow.
I think it's pretty well deserved. I am a big fan of the direction she's taken the show in this season. Yeah, I have no complaints. I think she's earned that based on the success they've had this year.
Yeah, I think she will do a great job in some of the other shows. All right, up next for DC News, The Flash gets a new showrunner for Season 6. Current showrunner Todd Helbing is stepping down at the conclusion of his current fifth season to focus on development for Warner Brothers Television. Eric Wallace, who has been a co-producer since Season 4, will take over.
I definitely think it's time for a new showrunner, just like I thought Arrow was necessary for that change, and they've reaped the benefit of that, I think, this season for Arrow. I'm hoping Flash gets a similar rejuvenation, because I find the show very, very stale this season. Like, I still like all the characters. I still like and look forward to the Flash, but it just feels kind of blah. Like, I'm just kind of watching the same thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's because they're dragging out the Cicada storyline.
Well, not only are they dragging out the Cicada storyline, in doing so, they keep just reusing the same, like, villain of the week format. Oh, like, it's the most procedural show of any of the shows. And it's just kind of, I don't know, it's just kind of boring. Like, to an extent, like, the show is still interesting and entertaining, but, like, it's so predictable.
They've been doing a lot better job with Arrow and Black Lightning. They just need to, they need to change things around a little bit.
Yeah, they just need to do something. Like, the show just needs to get to be shaken up a little bit and just break out of the formula that they're in. I think that's the biggest thing. I think as bad of a decision as it is to keep Cicada going, I think it would be more tolerable if the episodes themselves were at least more experimental and doing something different. But instead, we keep getting kind of the same old in terms of Flash episodes. And on top of that, they're not doing anything interesting with the villain. It just sort of leads to a sort of just shrug of a season.
All right. Up next for DC News, they've released a Batman versus Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles trailer. And after watching the trailer, I'm interested in seeing it.
I expect this will do pretty well for DC. I'm not going to lie. I think the comics, correct me if I'm wrong, the comics sold pretty well.
Yeah.
It's two extremely popular franchises, so I think DC will likely have a relative hit on their hands with this.
Yeah, I think so too. All right, and for our final bit of DC news, James Gunn has been rehired by Disney to direct Guardians of the Galaxy 3. And you're probably wondering, why is that DC news? Because when I saw that, I was wondering about Suicide Squad. And I had texted Cletus when I heard the news and asked him if he'd heard if he was still directing Suicide Squad. So I was happy to hear he still was. And then I saw another article later on saying that he was not planning on doing Guardians of the Galaxy 3 until he had finished Suicide Squad, which cool to hear.
What a mess in terms of how Disney's handled this whole thing. I think it's debatable whether or not he should have been fired, but like, this song and dance that they did is ridiculous. It's something, frankly, I'd expect from Warner Brothers and the way they've handled their franchise. It's also, I think it's hilarious that he is still doing Suicide Squad, which was, I think, pretty widely viewed as sort of an FU move by him to Disney. Like, screw you, I'll go and do a DC movie instead. And not only not just any DC movie, but the franchise that was clearly trying to model itself on what he was doing with Marvel. You know what I mean? Like, he clearly took, like, the Disney version, the DC version of what he was doing with Guardians and was like, screw you, I'm just going to keep doing it over here with your rival. But yep. Now he's back there, but he's still doing the FU movie. Like, that's just so weird.
It is. But I'm excited he's taking on Suicide Squad. I think he's going to do a really good job with it.
I agree. I mean, to be totally honest, it's extremely low bar for him to step over. I mean, he really just needs to make a mediocre movie, and it's going to look fantastic in comparison.
All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
And I'm Tony Heath.
And we have a sneaking suspicion that you don't actually listen to these promos.
So we're not going to make you listen to one. Bye!
Brought to you by the Watchathon of Rassilon, a podcast where Joe and Tony watch all of Doctor Who and then talk to you about it.
Available on the ESO Network or wherever else you get podcasts from.
But honestly, where else would you go?
WatchYourRassilon.com?
Oh yeah, that makes sense.
And we're back! But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. For you.
Let's talk Adventures of the Super Sons number 8. All right, so Rex Luthor gathers up his allies, the Injustice Army, while the Super Sons and Joker Jr. head to Robin's makeshift Bat Cave. I have to tell you, Clayce, I love the addition of A1-X, the basically a kid Green Lantern. He's not an astral Green Lantern. He's part of the GL Cadet program, but it kind of reminds me of the Police Cadet program I was in high school, because I don't think he really actually had a ring. I was looking in the artwork, and they didn't show his hand, so I could see a ring on him or not. But he was obviously wearing a uniform, but
yeah, I don't really remember seeing constructs either.
No, he didn't use any ring powers, anyways.
Right, which makes sense. Like, if he's just a cadet, you wouldn't want to give him the most powerful weapon in the universe. So.
Exactly. So I don't know how much help he's going to be to Robin and Superboy, but it's interesting to add another character in the mix.
Well, it's interesting, too, because it's kind of, we've got two kind of simultaneous kid versions of Green Lantern going on in two separate titles, because we've got the Teen Lantern over in Young Justice.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll tie that into the cadet program also.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
But they seem unrelated. I could be wrong.
Yeah, they probably are, but it'd be interesting if they did tie them in.
Yes.
So Joker Jr. betrays the Super Sons once again when it looks like Rex Luthor has the upper hand. Rex fires upon Joker Jr., hoping that he stays dead this time. So once again, he tries to betray the Super Sons, but this time Rex Luthor didn't really care. He's done with the Joker Jr.
He didn't betray them, though. It was all a ploy. They made it. They used him. They were trying to get to the portal off the planet, and with the Green Lantern cadet and
right.
Joker Jr. as the guards, and they get caught before they can use the portal, and so he tries to play it off like he's double crossing the Super Sons, but then he throws them into the portal.
Okay, I guess I misunderstood that scene.
Yeah, he's basically stalling / misdirecting Rex until he's able to get John and Damian off planet, and as soon as he does that, Rex is like, okay, and shoots him.
Okay, I guess I misunderstood that scene.
Yeah, no, he's not betraying them in that scene.
Okay, well, that's good to know. I was like, again? So we see the Super Sons escape with A1-X, and then Rex didn't seem to really care that they escaped this time, and he said he was going to let his quest for revenge go, and he's going to focus on taking over the galaxy. I don't know what his big plan to take over the galaxy is, but I guess we're going to find out next issue.
I was going to say, I bet we find out.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman number 66. Now, this isn't Batman 66. This is Batman issue number 66. We don't want to get confused here. This was an interesting issue where the whole issue focused on the question interviewing Catwoman. But the thing is, I think it's all in Bruce's head.
Yeah, that's definitely the implication.
He was trying to figure out why Catwoman left him at the altar, basically.
We've known since issue 50, at the end of issue 50, it was clear that Catwoman's her no wasn't really why, that wasn't really the real reason. And I love the way they finally, at the end, right, like, the whole thing is this interview, and right at the end, there's no even image, it's just text, like, really small, simple text. Okay, I lied. I really liked that. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that was cool. It was a great issue, I thought.
Yeah, I thought it was a super cool way to involve the question without the question actually being there.
Yeah. So when we announced the question being in this title a while back, we didn't know it wasn't not going to be the question. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
But great issue, and we still got the mystery still going on of who has Batman captured. We still don't know.
One thing I really like with this is that we're seeing, it's subtle in the way that Tom King is doing it, but we're seeing Batman do detective work in his subconscious. Like, we know right now he is currently knocked out, but because he's Batman, naturally he's still able to do detective work. And he's doing it through, like, these subconscious dreams. I find it really cool. We talk a lot about wanting to see Batman be a detective, and we're kind of, in an indirect way, we're seeing that. We're kind of seeing him put the pieces together while he's incapacitated.
Yeah. I love the big question the question had towards the end of the issue. He goes, if your reason for leaving Batman at the altar was to make Batman strong, why is he so damn weak?
Yeah.
And that's a good question.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, he's not asking it to the real Catwoman, so.
Right, right.
You know, she's off somewhere, so she doesn't realize what Batman's going through right now. Tom King just does a great job with his writing, and I'm very excited to get further into this story.
I agree. I know he's had this mapped out all the way to issue 100, he said, but, like, I would be very okay if he continued a new arc after that. Just saying. I don't necessarily need somebody else to take over.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Doomsday Clock number 9. Man, it's been a while since we talked about it.
It's been so long. But that was really my only complaint with this issue, was that this was by far the hardest one I've had in terms of remembering what's going on. I don't even know if this was the longest gap or not, but it feels the longest.
Yeah, it does. And we've talked about, if they're going to do it right, we'd rather them take their time and do it, and that's what they're doing.
I agree.
But this issue was so good, though.
It really was. And it's one of those things, like, this story is going to read very well. Once it's collected, all of these delays will be meaningless. I do think it is hurting the monthly sales of it. I'm sure that they are taking a hit because of the delays. But once you get this collected, this is going to be a really good story.
So, the world looks bleak for the metahumans as the event in Russia with Firestorm has turned the world against Superman. And though the world wants answers from Superman, we see he's incapacitated in the Hall of Justice. Now, we find out that all the other superheroes are racing towards Mars, except for Superman, obviously, Wonder Woman, and Batman. So the trilogy is not even heading there. But we see everybody else heading there, and I thought it was cool to see the different ships with the different groups, because we had the Hawks, we had the Green Lanterns, we had Martian Manhunter and some of the other regular jailers, Supergirl and Steel, we saw the Justice League Dark, Doom Patrol, the Bat Family, the Shazam Family, and we even saw the Charleston characters together in a ship. It was kind of cool.
That felt necessary. It felt like you kind of had to have, like, Blue Beetle and those guys go.
Oh,
considering
yeah,
their connection to Watchmen.
I just liked that. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah. This was, I would say, by far, this is the biggest issue we've seen so far in terms of, like, events happening. Like, the story has really picked up the pace in terms of, like, we're clearly heading towards the climactic action. Now, it was definitely a slow build up to it, and now stuff is really starting to happen.
Yeah, now it's starting to feel cosmic now.
Yeah.
You know, this is like turning into a big event, especially when we see the heroes confront Dr. Manhattan, And the thing is, he pays them little attention. He's more interested in the power rings and the magic they're throwing at him. I thought it was interesting that he stated that magic is the scraps of creation, kind of like random errors of in a computer code, discarded and forgotten, left to be picked up and used by those who find themselves discarded and forgotten.
Yeah, his interaction with them I thought was fascinating, just because it was like, you, especially because the way with the artwork, it just emphasizes, like, you've got Dr. Manhattan, who himself is a pretty fantastical character, but then you've got the bright, colorful costumes of all the DC heroes, and this is a guy coming from the gritty world of Watchmen, and he's sort of just kind of like, whoa, what is this? What's this? Like, you know what I mean? It would be like somebody, like, you know, somebody from our world suddenly being in a world full of superheroes.
Yeah, and Guy Gardner was definitely Guy Gardner in this.
Yes, he was.
he had some good jokes. Of course, you know, they come across Dr. Manhattan and he's buck naked. So we got some jokes about that. And even with the Shazam kids, one of them's like, Darla, cover your eyes. Oh, man. And then Dr. Manhattan is just... I don't know if he means to be, but he can be cruel sometimes. We saw that scene where he takes Ronnie back to where he became Firestorm with Dr. Stein, and it looked like Dr. Stein did it on purpose. It wasn't an accident.
Yeah, that was an interesting reveal there.
Yeah.
And what's, I thought the most, we've suspected for some time that Dr. Manhattan probably isn't actually the bad guy in this story. And this issue went a long way towards kind of suggesting that further.
Right.
That he's also just, he's antagonistic to be sure.
Yeah.
But there's also, and I'm clearly Ozymandias is up to something. And then at the end of the issue, we see Black Adam is making a move, but I also don't think it's Black Adam that's actually me. I feel like he's just seizing an opportunity that somebody else has created.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Let me back up to something else I have in my notes. So when Batman wakes up, he discovers that all the heroes have left the planet and that they had discovered the origin of the explosion was not Firestorm, but had originated from Mars. And whoever caused the explosion, their goal was to kill Superman. That's what Batman's theory is. But Batman doesn't believe it was the person on Mars. He thinks the heroes are being played. And we see him try to send a message to Mars, but he's unable to get it there. So Batman's figured it out. And I think we're going to see more of that next time. We see that when the heroes go up against Dr. Manhattan, we see them basically obliterate him. But we see him reform, and they're just kind of shocked when he comes back. It was interesting to see Captain Atom against Dr. Manhattan.
That was interesting. I did like that. That was a nice little kind of reference there.
So, really great issue, and I'm excited to see what happens in the next issue.
I really would like to read the next issue next month. I don't know if it is actually going to come out next month, but that would be nice.
It would be nice. I have no idea when the next one's going to be out.
It's such a good story. It is. It's a shame that it's had the delays that it's had, but it's been worth it because this story has been great because it's been Gary Frank doing the art the whole time. Like, I really think if there had been an odd issue that he didn't do, it would stick out so badly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, it's one of those things in the moment, it's very frustrating reading this so intermittently, but I know it will be worth it down the road. We're not there yet, and that's the frustrating part.
I think it's going to be an iconic story to go down in the DC history books.
I hope so. If it ends the way it's been going so far, it definitely should be.
Yep. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Green Arrow number 50. Martian Manhunter had given Green Arrow a box that was supposed to be a weapon for safekeeping, and the government wants this box, so they send Black Canary and a Black Ops team to retrieve it. Of course, Oliver refuses to surrender and goes on the run, and the government goes after him. We see him get away at the end of the issue. He opens the box and realizes there's nothing in there. Gets upset, quits being Green Lantern, and flees to Canada. And then when we see him walking away, we see the box glowing.
I thought this was a pretty dumb issue. I'm not going to lie.
It was a weird way to end the series.
It was clearly, like, everything we know behind the scenes about this makes this whole issue make sense. These writers were not writing towards this story. It was clearly just that this needs to end. You need to come up with some sort of ending for it. And they just sort of haphazardly threw something together. It makes no sense at any point in this story that Black Canary would think that it's a good idea for their government to get their hands on the ability to take the Justice League down. She would never go for that. And especially, so she wouldn't go for that in the first place, regardless of who had that. But she definitely wouldn't do that if it meant taking down Oliver. Like, that was, it was like the core premise of the comic didn't make sense. And when she inevitably sided with Ollie, it was like, yeah, duh. It never made sense that she was fighting him in the first place.
He just leaves that box lying in the snow. I'm wondering who's going to pick the sucker up.
The other thing that I thought was silly was throughout the whole thing, Oliver keeps referencing that this, he made this mess that he finds himself in. I'm like, did you though? Like, it was weird because the issue seems to be basically continuing to try to blame Oliver for his own problems. I was like, but this really doesn't seem like this is, like, I didn't get how this was his fault. Like, is he supposed to not safeguard this supposed weapon that isn't there when he opens up the box? But, like, what was he supposed to have done?
Yeah. I know.
I didn't get that. Like, the whole issue seemed to be focusing on him, like, still unable to not create problems for himself. And I'm like, but I really don't think he made this problem for himself.
I mean, he was just doing what he asked.
That's what I said. I was like, there are plenty of stories that you could tell that would prove that point. I'm not saying that you can't do that with Ollie. You definitely can. But this particular story didn't. It was just, I thought it was very sloppy. It didn't totally make sense, which I'm sure the writers, you know, they weren't prepared to tell this story. This was not where anything in the arc was the title was going towards.
Nope. We know because of DC News that they had to end the series. They just got on the book and they were told, yeah, Hey, you guys need to end this. So they did. Not a very great ending, in my opinion.
No, I mean, and it doesn't. I thought the weirdest thing was that it really references basically nothing in terms of everything that's led up. Like, it was not a capstone to the run at all.
No. And I wonder if we missed him getting this box at some point. I don't remember.
I bet it happened at some point in No Justice and we just missed it.
Yeah, because I don't remember.
Maybe there was a Green Arrow tie-in to No Justice that we missed that happened in.
That's possible.
It's one of those two. I'm thinking it happened in No Justice and we've both forgotten, no?
Yeah. Well, we know Green Arrow's coming back at some point because we talked about it in DC News last week. So I'm not sure if they're relaunching. I can't remember if they're relaunching the title. I forget what exactly is happening, but he is coming back at some point in the near future. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Justice League number 19. So the Justice League turned to Mixie Pilic for help against the Legion of Doom. If you notice, I said it right. The Legion only has to unlock two more dark energies until they awake Perpetua, and the Justice League mean to stop them here and now. So we see Mixie point the League towards the sixth dimension, the penthouse of the multiverse, as Starman called it, a place outside of time that only a select few beings are capable of going. And according to Mixie, the League must go there. But we find out that over the years, Mixie has been eradicating Superman's body with the energy that would allow him to make the trip. So Superman's able to go in there first. And supposedly, because he goes in and then the Justice League were surprised he came back right away. Well, if it's out of time, then. But anyways, Superman comes back. It's like, hey, I prepared the way for you. And then what was weird, so when we see the Justice League go through, they come across a future Justice League that tells them, hey, you guys have saved the universe, and we're going to tell you how. So they're about to get a story. And then at the end of the issue, we find out the real Superman has come to some dark place with skulls and no sons. And we see him kind of frustrated because he's gone into some sort of trap. Really interesting issue.
Yeah, I'm very intrigued to read the next issue, which I usually am with this title, but this one in particular is like, ooh, I really want to see where this story goes. This sort of, we know it's probably fake, but that sort of future version of the Justice League itself is very interesting. Like, I feel like that's got two or three issues worth of story to it. I don't know if we'll actually get that much, but like, that itself is interesting enough that I would read a couple issues on it.
Yeah, and those future costumes they have, I thought they looked pretty cool. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, the Green Lantern number 5. All right, Cletus, first thing I want to point out is that I was right. The Guardians did ask Hal Jordan to go rogue and infiltrate the Darkstars.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, it didn't really make sense that he would actually join the Darkstars. Especially not this version that Grant Morrison is writing, the like super cop version of Hal Jordan. It made no sense that he would do that.
So apparently there is a double agent within their midst, and the Guardians have asked Hal Jordan to expose them. He's supposed to sabotage the Darkstar's exotic weapons program and neutralize their controller, Mew. So we see Hal Jordan go through their weird training program successfully, completing their weird tasks and taking on the name Blackstar Parallax. But before he can meet with the controller, Mew, Hal Jordan must complete one final task to prove his loyalty. He must kill the enemy of the Darkstars and the hero of Ran, Adam Strange.
This was a pretty good issue, I thought. I mean, it was the kind of journey was weird, but interesting. You could kind of see, like, I liked the sort of everything was sort of a point to prove how to be a functioning member of the Black Stars, and it was all kind of interesting in that. But then getting the sort of reveal that we suspected, that he was undercover, and then getting Adam Strange at the end. I'm very curious to read the next issue and see where we go with it.
I'm wondering what he's going to do. I'm very curious what he's going to do.
I'm really liking this Green Lantern run a lot. Like, it's super, like, you know, out there. It's weird because, like, it is cosmic level stuff, but it's not at the same time. Like, it's not stuff that necessarily needs to involve the entire DC universe. It's not like the fate of the universe. It's just like Green Lantern business. Doing his thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I like that.
I do too. And this is an interesting take on the Darkstars, I thought. I mean, we just read a Darkstar story at the end of the last Green Lantern run. And this seems to be totally different, doesn't it?
Better. Just saying.
So, yeah, I'm really interested in the next issue, too. And I'm curious to see what Hal Jordan's going to do.
the thing I really like that the Grant Morrison's doing, and so in addition to the fact that the story that he's telling itself is very interesting, but I like that he's not like writing. It feels a lot like a lot of writers right now for DC feel the need to like make these big, massive landmark changes. Like, you have to read the next issue because this issue, everything changes forever for the Flash. Like, he'll never be the same because this new force has emerged. He's just like writing Green Lantern. You know what I mean? He's not like putting pressure on his title to live up to some like massive legacy. He's just writing an entertaining adventure that involves Green Lantern.
Yeah, and he's
I feel
really
like
got
there's
you.
A couple titles that could take a few hints from that.
Yeah, I agree with you there.
Like, not everything has to be cataclysmic. Like, sometimes you can just have like the Flash can just be the Flash and just like solve a mystery as the Flash. He doesn't need to like find some earth-shattering thing that changes who he is forever, like make some massive mythos change to the Flash. Like, if you keep the problem is too, when you do that, in the Green Lantern before this, the previous run of Green Lantern, I thought was repeatedly guilty of this. They kept trying to make these big, massive, permanent alterations to the status quo of Green Lanterns, and it was like most of these don't even stick. And so you're writing all of these issues as if they're going to be landmark issues, and then they're not. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
You'd be better served to just write a good read.
Exactly. Or like in Detective Comics, can we have Batman actually just solve a crime?
That's when it started. That was a so frustrating thing. It did start like that. I was like, ooh, just a murder mystery? Okay. And then it looked like it was trying to build something crazy. Yeah, I don't know. I just, like, yes, sometimes there are good things. I mean, like, the best run of Green Lantern ever, Geoff Johns, obviously massively changed the mythos of Green Lantern, introducing all those lanterns. But that was also over time.
Yeah,
he didn't do it all at once.
It was a slow build, and it was a great build.
And a lot of the issues still just involved Hal being a Green Lantern. That was the big thing. Like, he introduced a lot of new stuff, but Green Lantern still effectively was Green Lantern the whole time. Like, yep. There weren't that many major changes to how Green Lanterns operated during his entire run. There were very few. It was mostly just other things within the Green Lantern world were being added. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, sorry. Long story short, I really like Morrison's run a lot. It's what everything I was hoping that his run would be.
Yeah, he's been doing a really good job. All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week, Young Justice number 3. So this issue focused on Connor Kent. We get the backstory of how he ended up on Jim World. And in the present, Impulse finds him living on Jim World as a farmer. We get the big reveal that Connor Kent is married and has a kid. And we see the rest of the team imprisoned in a pit. And I like how Robin kept appearing at the only entrance or exit to that pit and disappearing while you see the balloon bubbles of the rest of the team discussing what's going on.
Yeah, I thought that was... I had forgotten what had happened in the last issue. So I was like, I thought they were about to fight. So I thought I liked that sort of kind of time jump ahead. Like, oh, they lost and ended up imprisoned. And then the sort of mini twist that not only is Superboy is a farmer and has a family, but he's also uninterested in being Superboy. I thought that was interesting too.
Yeah. Cause we see him when the law enforcement of Jim World comes, we see Connor Kent get down on his knees and put his hands behind his head. And
the only thing I thought was kind of silly with that interaction was they pay no attention to the fact that he's wearing a Superman shirt.
I know.
The whole time. And then right at the end, they're like, this is extremely suspicious. And they're right. Like, they're obviously correct. But I was like, this only now is suspicious. He's lived there for how many years? And for whatever reason, he's choosing to wear his exact uniform. And only now somebody's been like, hey, wait a minute. That was the only thing. I was like, I mean, okay. I'm glad that there was some competence shown by the bad guys, but also, like, seems pretty delayed competence.
Well, you got to remember, this title's got some silliness to it. So.
That's true.
But still a fun read, though.
It still feels like we're kind of in, like, first or second gear with this story. It doesn't totally feel like it's kicked in yet, but it feels like we're getting ready to kind of get the ball rolling more with this story.
Yeah, they're still building, it feels like, so.
Yeah.
All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and we'll come back. We'll talk our CW shows.
Dragons do not do well in captivity.
How do you know this?
That's what I do. I
podcast.
And I know things.
Hi, I'm Robin Paris from The Room, and you're listening to We Podcast and We Know Things.
Hello, this is Grant Kirkhope. I'm famous for saying Uminaka and Ikabokum, and you're listening to We Podcast and We Know Things.
It's more than Nick, okay, man. You're listening to Greg and Sam on the We Podcast and We Know Things, y'all.
And we're back. Let's talk Supergirl Season 4, Episode 14, Stand and Deliver. So the episode opens up with the Elite making plans to attack. We see Menagerie try to get a human snack, but is stopped by Supergirl and the Super Friends. And we see the Elite attack Ben Lockwood as he's giving a speech. And as he's giving a speech as the new director of Alien Affairs, and Supergirl is there to save him.
This was a good episode. I continue to enjoy. Ben Lockwood is a really good villain. This has been a great choice on the show's part. It's the kind of threat that is believable that Supergirl would have a hard time stopping. Like, he's not in any way a physical threat, but the ideals that he stands for are not something that she can just punch away.
The problem is, Ben Lockwood is not the only villain. She's got two villains. We've also got Manchester Black. They're both villains on opposite sides. They're both leaders of terrorist groups.
Yep. I have to say, so one thing I liked and disliked what they did with the Elite. I thought it was cool the way they slowly picked off one member at a time of the Elite.
Uh-huh.
That part I liked. But what I do feel a little shortchanged in that we really only got like 1.5 episodes with them. I feel like they could have kept that team going a little bit more. And they'll probably come back again, but it just seems kind of quick. Like, we just really got them as a team last episode.
Yeah, we did. I don't think they're done with them yet, so, myself.
Yeah. The one thing I also was surprised by, I honestly didn't realize that they hadn't gotten Brainy's ring back until they were doing previously on Supergirl, and they showed him asking about his ring. I was like, oh, I thought John grabbed it when he knocked him out. I was wrong.
No, he's upset about that. It's understandable he'd be upset about
that. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I just didn't remember that he didn't get his ring back, or didn't realize he didn't get his ring back until the very helpful recap at the beginning of the episode.
And that's what they're there for.
Exactly.
All right, so later in the episode, we see that Brainiac, Ben Lockwood's going to give a rally. And, of course, the Elite's going to attack it. But we also see that Brainiac has organized a peaceful alien march, which it was kind of cool to see John and Kara all kind of join in into that. And we got to see James Olsen do something that's usually his job in the comic books, and that's take photos.
Been a while. I have to say, I got what they were trying to do. I liked that he was a photographer again. I thought that was really cool. And the photo that they had with it was a good photo, but I did feel like my eyes were rolling a little bit when they're like, your photo literally changed the minds of hundreds of people. I'm like, come on, guys. Like, I thought that was a little bit like, it was like, okay, let's calm down here. It's a picture.
It did help shelving the idea of the repealing the Alien Amnesty Act, though.
Well, but what I didn't understand was one of the things they were talking about ahead of time, which is true, is that Ben Lockwood would not be able to just do that.
No, he would not.
That's not how the U.S. government works.
No.
And then when they were like, "Wow, we succeeded," and I was like, "But he couldn't do it in the first place."
Yeah,
that was the thing. I was like.
Congress.
Yeah, I get that they turned public opinion enough that he wasn't going to be able to build up a quick like fervor for it and get it done, but it was like, it wasn't like he was about to just sign something into law. He can't do that. Like, the U.S. government on the show works the same way that the real U.S. government does for the most part.
Yeah, it would have taken an act of Congress to do that, and
It was odd because the show acknowledged the fact that he couldn't just like snap his fingers and make a law disappear, but then they still felt the need to give the team a clear win at the end of the episode. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it just felt like they needed to be like, we won. It was like, yeah, but you could have. I don't know. I feel like they could have said that without. Being like, yeah, we stopped that from being repealed. It's like, it wasn't going to get repealed immediately.
No. All right. Well, we get to the end of the episode, and we see that James gets shot over his pitcher. Is this the end of James?
No.
I know. I put probably not. But I do want to ask you this. Do you think James is going to get Lena's superhuman cure or whatever?
Absolutely, yes. This was clearly the setup for him to get Lena's thing. They've been setting up that. That has been, to me, they've been hinting at that since she started working on it. It was always like, even in her subconscious, I think it was really meant for James. Like, she did it to protect him specifically. And now we've had the inevitable. James gets injured, and now he gets the serum.
Yeah, I thought that's where they're going with that too.
I'm not saying this as a complaint, by the way. It's a logical continuation of the story, of a good storyline. So I'm not a complaint. It's just that, to me, clearly where the story is going.
Yeah, and I would agree with you there.
And there is precedent for it in the comics. One of the things that this show does is it clearly pulls heavily from Silver Age Supergirl stuff. And Jimmy Olsen had a lot of experience with superpowers in the Silver Age. So not unprecedented in terms of comic stuff.
No. I'm excited for next week's episode because John Cryer is supposed to be on there as Lex Luthor. So we're getting that episode next week.
Yeah, I'm excited to watch it. I'm still not sold on paper as him as Lex, but I am willing to be proven wrong.
Yeah, excited to see what they're going to do with that. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Arrow, Season 7, Episode 15, Training Day. So the episode opens up with Team Arrow and the police department trying to work together. And the problem is that the mayor is trying to make Team Arrow regular police officers without their vigilante uniforms and without their weapons. And it just becomes an epic failure on their first time out.
The one thing I didn't totally get was that they felt like they backtracked a little bit on the mayor in this episode. Like, she had been convinced, but then they were like, she's looking for a reason to shut it back down, which is not necessarily unbelievable, but it felt like we regressed in character progression in terms of what the mayor's feelings towards vigilantes were.
I don't know, because
for the sake of the plot.
She, last week, you know, she let the rest of the team get deputized, but I don't think she was happy about it.
Yeah.
Or at least I got
that
sense.
Like I said, it was not necessarily unbelievable. It just felt like a regression on some level.
But obviously she was trying to
restrict it. It made for a good episode, though. Anyway.
We also see, after that epic failure, Oliver and Felicity try to do things on their own and go back to their old vigilante ways. That becomes an epic failure also, because their target ended up getting released. Especially when you try to shove your villain's face into acid to get him to confess. That's not going to stick up in a court of law.
Yeah.
But we finally got the team to compromise, or Dinah to compromise with the team and let Team Arrow kind of be Team Arrow but work within the law. That went fairly well enough that they decided to give Team Arrow their own task force, which I thought was pretty cool. We can finally get them back to doing what they need to be doing.
The big thing that we got in this episode, though, I thought was it was by far the smallest storyline, but I thought the biggest in terms of impact on the overall season. We see Dinah interacting with Bronze Tiger in prison, and she ultimately finds out that it was Emiko that killed Diaz.
Yes, that was an interesting reveal.
That was surprising. So now I'm really curious what's going on with Emiko. Last time we saw her that she obviously knew and on some level was working with Dante. And now I'm really curious what is going on with her story.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Then also in this episode, we see in the future William and Mia starting to work together. And I like their little scene where they found the tape player and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting. And I'm really interested to see them go over the wall and see what the Glades are like now.
Yeah, we've seen glimpses when we were in Wild Dog's office. We know that it's relatively a utopia, especially compared to Star City outside of the walls. So yeah, that'll be interesting to see, you know, kind of like outside that building.
Another great episode of Arrow.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that continue. Like I said, one of the smallest part of the episode was still super interesting because it has massive ramifications. And that was something that Arrow hasn't really done. Oftentimes, the C or D storyline was forgettable and basically a waste of time. And in this case, it said the C storyline is like the most impactful part of the episode.
Yeah, really interesting to see what's going to happen with that.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Black Lightning, Season 2, Episode 15, The Book of Apocalypse, Chapter 1, The Alpha. Man, it's always a mouthful to say their titles.
It is.
So in this episode, Jefferson lays down the law of the superhero code. If the family is to work together as a superhero team, there are some ground rules. Number one, no telling anyone. Number two, no doing anything without backup. And number three, no killing anyone. Something tells me these codes are going to get broken.
They seemed like they were on their way towards getting broken within this episode.
I know.
I have to say, the biggest twist in this episode for me personally was that this was the second to last episode of the season. I had no idea. Like, this episode ended, I was like, damn, that was a good episode. And then the preview was like, next week, the season finale. I was like, what?
Exactly. When I saw that, too, I was like, what? Because I was not expecting it either. We had no – I heard nothing about the season finale coming up.
I was stunned by that. I know that's not, it has nothing to do with the story itself, but I was stunned. I was literally like, what, are you kidding me? It's just getting good.
Yeah. We see Tobias put a commercial out. It was basically a commercial on the dark web showing off one of his metahuman weapons. And this dude is just tearing through the city. What I found weird was Jefferson's kind of floating above the city there. And I was wondering, why is it taking him so long to go after the fire dude? Because he basically gets to that little rally and burns those people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I was like, are you going to go save people? Are you just going
to do your job? I don't know, maybe.
So we also see Lala go after Tobias in this. And what I thought was strange was he got all those knives in his chest, but he didn't die. He just kind of stayed alive and yanked him out. I thought that was weird.
That made sense. I don't know. It was weird, but it was like, okay. Within the logic that they've created for that character, I was like, I believe that he wouldn't die from that. I don't know if that makes sense, but I was like, sure. From what we've established with his character, I can buy that.
He really wants to kill Tobias, but I was thinking, does he really want to have a tattoo of Tobias on him and then him in his head? I mean, I think it was the last episode where we kept seeing them fighting in his head, the two characters he's already killed.
Well, you know what was interesting, though, is even after he realized that he killed his friend, we saw that tattoo get added to him, but that guy was not involved in the argument in the car. It was still just the other two.
Yeah, that's true. But I wonder if we'll see him in the future.
Possible.
So we didn't really see any of that going on this episode.
Well, I have to admit, what I'm really curious about is what storyline is going to get wrapped up in the following episode. There are so many loose threads. I think it's pretty clear Tobias is not going to be defeated this again.
Yeah, I mean,
fine. That's totally fine.
That's what I thought, too. I wonder if we're going to have a battle between Black Lightning and Lala and maybe some other metahumans. What do you think?
I don't know. I feel like maybe there'll be a conclusion to Lala's story, but I kind of feel like he's going to keep going. Tobias is going to keep going. I feel like we'll get a conclusion to the girlfriend, the shape-shifting girlfriend story.
Yeah.
I do feel like that will wrap up. And I think that I feel like the conclusion is basically going to be the full emergence of the other daughter, like as a fully costumed hero.
Yeah. Well, when we left her at the end of this episode, she was basically... her powers were out of control again. She's kind of lying in the street. Because she went after Tobias, of course. I knew that was coming. And her powers got out of control once again.
I really like I have to say this really threw me for a loop when it was like, oh, this is the second to last episode. I'm like, how? There's so much left to tell.
I know.
I do think it. I have to say one thing. It does help is that it. There's clearly you already know where the next season's going to go. You know what I mean? Like it makes it easy for the show to, you know, not repeat a storyline or have a repetitive villain because they instead of dragging a season on too long, they're almost cutting it a little bit too short. And continuing it over to the next season.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to see Black Lightning have to deal with some of those metahumans.
I agree.
So, and Tobias selling them. So, it's going to be really interesting. Maybe he's going to have to track down these metahumans after they get sold. Who knows? Who knows where they're going with this?
I do feel like season one clearly left Tobias hanging as a threat, but it did feel like when they defeated that guy, it did feel like kind of a natural conclusion to that season. You know what I mean? Especially yeah. towards the end. The last two or three episodes felt like it was all driving towards that conclusion. This one, it seems much more unclear.
It feels
what
like it's
the
gonna,
conclusion that they're driving towards is.
It's to me, it feels like it's going to be to be continued, kind of.
Yeah.
Something's going to go wrong. I just feel it.
I agree with you completely there. I do think something's going to go very wrong at some point. It's going to leave
It's going to leave us
mess.
Hanging going, no!
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Flash, Season 5, Episode 16, Failure is an Orphan. This episode begins with Nora traveling to 2019. This episode begins. Let me start over.
She does travel to 2019. That is true.
I know, but that's not what I meant to put down. So this episode begins with Nora traveling to 2049 to visit Thawne. He tells her the time for Flash's final confrontation with Cicada is here. However, they notice the timeline is changing, which means some new variable has entered the mix. Do you think Thawne has been waiting for this change? Do you think Thawne is trying to manipulate the timeline either to change his own destiny or to get revenge on Barry somehow?
Absolutely. 100% yes. I could be wrong, but that's still like I would need to be proven wrong for me not to think that Thawne's up to something.
He's definitely up to something. I'm waiting for the big reveal. It's a slow burn is what it is.
But like not in a good slow burn, like what Black Lightning has done with Whale. It's not the same thing. Like it's a slow burn because they're insisting on focusing on a different villain that they don't have to.
Namely Cicada. So the big task in this episode is for Barry to convince Cicada to take the metahuman cure.
I like that they go with the Flash appeal to the villain thing, even though, the show is openly acknowledging that they are stuck in cliches with this show. They're like, oh, the Flash always appeals to the hero. Sorry, always appeals to the villain, and they find some, like, good part of themselves left and go with what Barry says. I'm like, then stop writing that. Like, you do that all the time. That tells me that you keep writing the same story. But the thing that frustrated me again with that scene, I did like that Cicada basically initially said no and went away. I liked that because it would have, I think, you know, again, just been that, you know, just the cliche of Flash appeals to the villain sees their side and goes, okay. So I liked that Cicada said no initially. Why do they refuse to put the cuffs on him and bring him to the vault or whatever they call their prison cells? Why? Any other villain, they would capture them and throw them in the pipeline. That's what I'm thinking of. Throw them in the pipeline, and then Flash would make his pitch to them from there. Where even if he says no, he's still not a threat anymore. I know ultimately it doesn't matter. Because he ultimately does say yes. But in the moment, once again, they have him incapacitated. They have the ability to cuff him and bring him to the pipeline. and they don't, and he gets away again. And ultimately, again, I get it. It doesn't matter because he does ultimately say yes to taking it. But why? Why is Cicada the one villain that they just like? It's just not. Is it just not an option to put him in the pipeline?
I don't know.
I don't understand. I do not understand why the show refuses them to do that. I just don't get it.
They ended up putting somebody else in the pipeline, didn't they?
They did. That was the thing. It was like, it's not like the show's forgotten that the pipeline exists. They've used the pipeline multiple times this season.
Who did they put in there this episode?
It was that weird acid guy.
Oh, the acid guy. That's who it was.
They like introduced the villain just to like not use him at all. I was like, great. That is the most Flash thing that you could do.
Cicada agrees to take the metahuman cure. But the weird thing is that second Cicada shows up, you know, Amber as an adult, basically. Is that what her name was, Amber?
I think so.
I can't remember.
Let's say yes.
Okay. Well, she shows up to kills Dr. Ambrose and takes off with her dad. My big question was, how did she come back in time? What's this reverse Flash is doing? That's what I was wondering.
I have to admit, it is unclear how she's also coming back in time. You can clearly see kind of what the season is building towards, where you've got the offspring of the hero taking on the offspring of the villain, but in their parents' timeline instead of their own, which is kind of interesting, but it doesn't seem interesting enough to drag this story out an entire season.
Agreed.
Also, just logically, I saw somebody else mention this. It was either on our feed or in one of the ESO feeds. Somebody raised this point, and I have to agree with them. I don't understand why they wouldn't have given the cure to the daughter first anyway.
Yeah, that would make more sense, wouldn't it?
How would that not, like, would that not prove your point to Cicada better than anything else? Being like, hey, we have this cure. We just use it on your niece, and now she's recovered, she's healthy, we can do the same for you.
That does make more sense.
You know what I mean? Like, I understand if you do that, then it takes away the villain for the end of the season, which is this future, like the improved Cicada 2.0. But Cicada is not an interesting enough villain for that to be worth it. That's the thing. It's like,
only because they didn't write Cicada to be a better villain, my opinion.
I actually think Cicada, well, this is my big thing. I actually think Cicada was a good villain. I just don't think he's a 23-episode villain. That's my big complaint with him. I think he would have been a perfect, perfect 9-episode villain. Especially if you really leaned into the Jack the Ripper thing and you don't show him. I think they showed him too much. But if you do, like, if you play it like a Jack the Ripper, you really only see him killing and getting away. Like, the heroes just know nothing about this guy other than he's this menace that they can't track down, and lean into the detective work and lean into the mystery. That's a really good 9-episode arc.
That would have been really interesting.
What they've done for 23 episodes, though, is not good. That's the problem. I don't think Cicada is bad as a villain. I think he's just bad as a 23-episode villain.
I agree with you. It would have been more interesting to see Joe, Barry, and Ralph being more detectives trying to solve this than the way they've done it here.
That would be something new. It would be Flash breaking out of its mold. You know what I mean? Like, instead of doing these weekly things where Flash learns a moral every episode, it's just them slowly uncovering the mystery and slowly tracking down this killer. And you could make, and in that case, if you were to do that, you could also make Cicada a little bit more competent at the beginning than he was. Like, this is not a complaint. Like, I like what they did in terms of, like, him learning how to be a supervillain. But you could approach it differently instead and have him already be, like, good at what he's doing. And he's so good that he's able to cover his tracks enough to keep getting away from the Flash. And then you really only get a lot of detail, and you really only see him in that, like, last, like, you know, episode 7 to 9 range. And before that, he's really just kind of this menace in the shadows. I don't know. That would be super interesting. I would have loved to have watched that. And I know it's just, It's just frustrating because it doesn't feel like this season needed to be bad. Like, this feels super avoidable, and they just did it anyway.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do next season with the new showrunner. One other thing I wanted to mention was Ralph was notably missing from this episode and the last few episodes. I wonder when he's going to be back.
I have found it a little odd. It seems like they're not even explaining it. They're just like, we don't know how to include Ralph, so we're just going to not.
I know. Weird, huh?
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. Doom Patrol, Season 1, Episode 5, Paw Patrol. Seeing that title, all I could think of was The Kid Show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I thought that was a great title.
I have to say, this is one of the strangest episodes we had yet.
It's so good. I just loved how weird it got. Like, they were like, what's the weirdest way that we could resolve this really weird storyline, and went with it.
To stop the decreator... It took the recreator. So I thought it was funny. They just bring in another eye in the sky. So you have the two eyes staring at each other.
It was so funny. It was just like the most absurd way to resolve the thing. Like, well, let's go back in time and invent a cult around the recreator and then have that so that it emerges at that point. It was so like sci-fi, but also like weird and absurd. It was perfectly Doom Patrol, I thought.
Yeah, it was. And we got some more of Jane's backstory in this also. We got to see another one of her personalities, Dr. Harrison, who has the power.
I have to say,
one
thing I've really liked that the show has done, they really have done a lot of versions of Jane. Like, you know what I mean? They didn't just say, like, yeah, there's 64 versions of her, and they only ever show three. I feel like they do cycle through a lot. I feel like we have seen, I think, close to double digits now, I think, probably.
Probably.
That's pretty good, especially for only five episodes in. That's not bad.
It was interesting to see this version of her personality, Dr. Harrison, because a lot of the other ones we see anger issues and stuff like that with, but this one was more cunning, I thought.
Yes.
Now, I was going to ask you, does it Mr. Nobody feels like he's all powerful, or it seemed like he was more powerful in this episode than they betrayed him before, and it feels like he's just toying with the Doom Patrol as if they're playthings?
I thought the opposite. This felt like the first time he showed any level of vulnerability. Because he clearly has no ability to stop the Decreator initially. That's why he's panicking. He's like, wait, I wasn't even in the last two episodes. I can't be defeated here. This is the first time we saw any level of vulnerability. And the doctor even remarks on that. I don't know. To me, it felt pretty in line with he basically is able to – he's the narrator. And that's the thing I find so like metafictional and interesting about him is that as the narrator, he can effectively do anything because he just adds it to the story. Do you notice that? Because we saw like in this episode, like when he goes to get Jane in the past, he says, and then her bonds came undone, and then they come undone. Like, his power is essentially that he's the narrator of the story. And how interesting is it to have the narrator be the villain? Like, that's just so cool to me.
Yeah, that is a cool idea. And, I'm really enjoying him as a villain.
Alan Tudyk in playing that role is perfect too. Like, it's so good.
Yeah, it is. All right, well, that wraps up another episode for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
Yeah, so for the last couple of weeks, I've been reading a novel by Tom King. I think it's the only one he's ever done, called A Once Crowded Sky. It's pretty good. It definitely it borrows a lot from the sort of Watchmen aesthetic. It's basically about a world where it was a comic book world. It was a superhero world. And then a big crisis happens, as they do in comic books. And it takes all of the superpowers away. And it's all of them kind of living in this world. All these heroes are still there, but now they don't have their powers anymore, and it's kind of like how they adapt and live in that world. It's really good. It's a very good book.
Interesting. All right, and for my shout-out, I'm just going to shout-out. I was happy to go see Raiders of the Lost Ark on the big screen. I don't think I've ever seen it on the big screen, and I had a chance to see it this weekend, and it's one of my favorite Indiana Jones movies. So I was happy to go see that.
That's awesome.
So that was a fun time. All right, well, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach our feedback line at 317-564-9133, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, coming up next week, we'll be talking Catwoman, Justice League Dark, Supergirl, Superman, The Flash, Wonder Twins, Wonder Woman, the CW shows, and Doom Patrol. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Time to go.
You sure this is necessary?
The Guardians of the Universe seem to think so.
How long will you be gone?
But we will be back, little brother.
I wish I could go with.
I doubt your mother would approve.
I'll miss you.
Perhaps you could water the plants in my apartment while I am gone.
Be careful, all right?
May the gods be with you all.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the T Public Store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.